Okay. Hi. Remember January 17th? You knew nothing about Bronfenbrenner, January 17th. Phew. You've learned a whole new language. Just to check on that language, we'll have a review session after class. And tomorrow at 4 here. And the exam is Friday at 11:45. Bring a number 2 pencil. Any questions about review or the exam? Okay. For the review sessions, both of them, I'll invite your questions, anything that doesn't make enough sense yet, and then I have some exercises for us to play with as a group and practice applying Bronfenbrenner to additional kinds of situations to see if we can figure out how to interpret them and then how we might want them to be conducted using a developmental perspective. Okay? Any housekeeping? No? Any housekeeping questions? Any? Yes? It would be possible. Remind me? Yeah. And I will also try to remember to record both review sessions. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. We were talking about divorce. I was talking about divorce. You were thinking about divorce. And some of the significant viewpoints when I think about divorce, one is, as I said, it's not an event but a process. It has a number of transitions. So every transition can be interpreted using the notion of an ecological transition. What are the changes in roles or settings that each person is going through? And then if it's a change in roles, how clear are the roles? How contradictory are the roles? How compatible are they? How much preparation is there for them and how much support? If it's a change in setting, how much preparation is there for that particular switch, for the new setting? How compatible are the activities in that setting compared to the previous settings? Are you going into those new settings with a transcontextual dyad, somebody you have a primary dyadic relationship with? All of those questions based on the hypotheses are applicable anytime you have a transition. So what I'm going to do for a little bit this afternoon is to look at some of the complications of those transitions and how we might make them easier or more developmentally constructive for children or teenagers going through them. When we look at the marital conflict, we see a change in the parental dyad. That, of course, will have an effect on the parent-child dyads. And the microsystem generally will be upset. So when parents start to have major conflict, when they start threatening to move out, when we learn things that we'd rather not know, the microsystem suffers because it's difficult to carry out the routines that have made up that pattern as we've learned to do it. Now, if the pattern has been conflict and you've had lots of fighting and arguing and bad feeling, negative affect for months or years, then maybe it's just coming to a head and separation, removing one person or more from the microsystem, from the setting, will calm things down. When there is a separation, then somebody is moving into a new setting, and if it's one of the parents, then you're creating a mesosystem home. Instead of a microsystem that is home, you now have a mesosystem, and you have to look at the links between those settings. So what's happening as people are moving back and forth? How much time are you spending in each setting? Are you really viewing each setting as home, or is it just a place where you're forced to go visit the parent and none of your stuff is there and there isn't a microsystem pattern that's comfortable in that setting? So for many families at separation, there's a fair amount of, maybe an unfair amount of time during which the microsystem in one setting is not really established, and it's not established as a place that's developmentally appropriate for children. The longer that goes on, the more difficult it will be for children to adapt to having a mesosystem, because they'll be resisting or confused by their participation in the setting that doesn't have a comfortable microsystem up in it. With the conflict comes negotiation and all of the implications for power, affect, and reciprocity that go into negotiation about living situation, about money, about parenting time, about activities. People start getting involved with lawyers, typically, with family court, and go through a process that may take months or years to become final. And it is always a stressful involvement. You don't go to family court, you don't deal with lawyers, you don't deal with child support magistrates, you don't deal with the other party and opposing lawyers without a fair degree of stress. Nobody sails through it without having some negative consequences for that. Then comes divorce, creating a binuclear family with smaller microsystems, fewer adult child dyads, changed roles for everybody, and then we'll talk about dating and repartnering and blended families a little bit later today. Okay, I was looking at some of the changes that have happened in the macro system in our society over the last few years, 50 years, and I wanted to review some of those. And I want to emphasize the point again that the macro system has rapidly changed. The chrono system has been speeding right along. And our society has changed its interpretation of divorce, the way we deal with divorce, our expectations for divorce, and our understanding of its developmental impact. And the changes are of many sorts. And one of the very important points is that the macro system is still changing. We have not reached a consensus about divorce and how to do it. We've not reached a steady state. So laws about divorce, laws about children in divorce, and laws about parenting continue to change. And they have been changing ever since I became a professional involved in the field about 35 years ago. So what we're seeing is that just about the time you think you have a handle on how it's done and what it means and how to think about it, that keeps changing. That has a couple of implications. One is that people who've experienced divorce 20 or 30 years ago have a viewpoint about it which may not be applicable to people going through divorce now. So one of the things we have to watch out for is that people get their advice from people whose experience is out of date. People get advice from people whose understanding of divorce is no longer valid. It's not a valid view of the world that they live in, because that world has changed. So if you rely on an older generation, a member of an older generation, to advise you on divorce and what to do in it and what to do with your children and how to help them, their advice sometimes is not only bad, it's occasionally illegal, because they haven't kept up with the laws. One of the results of that is that often people who've been divorced for 20 or 30 years watch people get divorced now, and they're jealous. They're very envious because of the way things are done now. I participated in a conversation a number of years ago where a couple who were dating were having conflict. They were both divorced, but one of them had been divorced for a long time, and the other one was recently divorced. And their conflict was because the recently divorcing person, who happened to be the male in this situation, was treating his children and his ex-wife the way you're supposed to do it. He was still involved as a father. He was being cordial and civil and supportive of the relationship with the children. He was trying to do all the things that we suggest you do if you're trying to stay involved developmentally appropriately with your children and avoid conflict. And the woman in the couple had had a very angry, bitter divorce in which that didn't happen. And they were having difficulties as a couple because she was so jealous of the way he was treating his ex-wife that she was picking fights with him. It took them a couple of hours of talking through what their experience was to figure out that her nose was really out of joint, because she had been treated badly in her divorce. She had fared poorly financially because her divorce came before major changes in the laws, and her ex-husband had not maintained a supportive approach to her children, and she was legitimately and appropriately angry about that and hadn't gotten over that, but she was carrying it into her new relationship in a way that was creating problems there. So the poor guy was kind of sad because he was doing everything right, what the psychologists had recommended, and as far as his children were concerned, he was doing a good job. Even his ex-wife wasn't too terribly upset and was pleased with the way he was dealing with it. But his new partner couldn't deal with it. She was just out of sync with it. And I've seen that now several times, where people whose experience predated some of the major changes, it was very difficult for them then later to watch other people do it right. One of the issues in the rapid change is that sometimes people, as I said, will give advice that turns out to be illegal. Because the laws have changed, the laws about property division and the laws about contact with children. So one of the things that came up recently, I left out a step. I supervise a program in Vermont, which is a 4-hour parent education workshop that's required for all parents going through divorce. So I have, with other people, created a curriculum, and I supervise the instructors for that. So I constantly get stories back from the instructors about what they're encountering in the classroom as they're talking with parents about how to do it. Essentially, we're teaching parents how to divorce and do it in a way that reduces the amount of difficulty for themselves and for their children. But regularly I get reports back that people are still being advised by family and friends, if somebody is not paying the support that he or she is supposed to pay for child support, that they not let him or her spend time with the children. And we also hear parents who are being prevented from spending time with their children threaten, or they are advised sometimes to, well, just withhold the support check, that'll teach her. The problem with that is that in Vermont it is illegal to connect support payments to time with the children. They're completely separate, and it's illegal to connect them. So support is ordered, and you pay it or not. If you don't pay it, you get a contempt of court citation. Time with children is ordered and organized by the court, and it has nothing to do with whether or not you pay support. But up until that law was changed about 7 years ago, it was very common for people to fight about financial issues, non-payment of support, by withholding the children, hiding them, not letting you see them. That's illegal. You can't do it. But it still comes into our classes as advice that people want to give. It's advice to do something illegal. And it will get you fined. It will get you contempt of court citation. I don't know anybody who's gone to jail yet, but the threat is there. So the law has changed, and that's part of the macro system change, so that the law now assumes that both parents should maintain appropriate relationships with their children. And the law supports that. That's the anticipation in the law. The only way you can be forbidden to have time with your children is to have been convicted of child abuse or be declared an unfit parent and have your rights terminated. But that's very rare. Even if you're an abusive parent, you have the right to continue a relationship with your child. It just has to be supervised, as long as it's clear that you can do that in a supervised way that isn't directly harmful to your children. And that's a huge change in the law, because it recognizes the dyads that both parents have with their children and says divorce does not change those. It changes them, but it doesn't eliminate them. What used to happen was we had fault, and somebody had to be wrong. And that was typical up into the 1970s and then gradually changed. And the rationale was that if you had this parental dyad with kids, somebody in the microsystem, somebody in the family was not doing his or her job and was doing it in such a way that they deserved to be thrown out. And that is the image of divorce that was manifest in the law up into the 1970s and in 80s in some states. What it meant was that you removed the person at fault, the person who'd done wrong, from that microsystem and literally from the family, which meant that this now was a broken family. It was broken. It had been broken apart, and one person was ejected from it. In the 1970s, psychologists were still publishing books which said that this is such a difficult situation to be in that now we're going to put mother out here and the kids are still here. This is now a single-parent family. It's a one-parent family. And the language implies that the other parent is gone. It's a one-parent family. And what that implies is that this parent is no longer a parent, is no longer going to be involved. That relationship is gone. So it's a broken one-parent family. These are kids from a one-parent broken home. And this person is out there drifting, hopefully going someplace else and staying out of the way. In the 1970s, psychologists were still recommending that these people disappear from their children's lives. have as little contact as possible. Some of you probably have parents who grew up in a situation where one of the parents had disappeared or had very little contact, moved out of state, stayed as far away as possible, and that was actually encouraged by psychologists at that time. That doesn't happen anymore. The macro system, remember, is the beliefs and the consistencies, and that includes the language. This family was broken before the divorce. It wasn't functioning well. What this refers to is the structure, meaning it's no longer an intact nuclear family. Many of us prefer to use the word broken for the function. The dysfunctional family, it's not working. And so it needs to be fixed. Now we don't use broken. Now we don't have to prove that somebody was at fault. So we have no-fault divorce as a way of fixing what's wrong with the family. And what that implies then, and as it's evolved, what it means is that we take the dysfunctional family and we make it more functional by reducing the ongoing conflict between the parents. There's an implication of that which we're still working towards. Some states have tried experiments with it and others have not. Vermont has not yet. If a family is dysfunctional, one of the ways to fix it is family therapy or marriage counseling. So if parents start to talk about not being able to get along and the marriage doesn't work and they're unhappy and they're at each other's throats, the relatively obvious first step would be to try to change that, to try to fix that. And one of the pieces of advice that I give parents is that before they separate, before they even talk about divorce, they want to think about what their children are going to ask them in about 20 years. And they want to be prepared to give the right answer. Because what children will ask, and some of you have asked your parents, is, what did you do to try to stay together? And I tell parents that what you need to try to do is professional help, marriage counseling, some professional directed, guided attempt to create the basis for a good relationship. At some point, most people liked each other when they got married. It may have been a brief time, it may have been a hallucination, but anyway, they got married. So you can assume that there was some, at least, attraction, and maybe you can pick up on that. So the first thing that a dysfunctional couple is advised to do is get some professional help. How often do they do that? When I teach the course, it's not part of our standard curriculum, but I always ask, I've got a room full of parents, they're divorcing, and so we go through all the introductions. I convince them that it's okay that the judge mandated them to be there. People don't like being ordered to attend. If you order them to attend, 95% of them do. If you don't, 10% voluntarily come if you give a program and it doesn't cost anything. And they're the ones who don't need it. So it's mandated in this state. It's not in many other states. So they don't get many of the parents. We get everybody there and they're sitting there.
I'll be damned if you're going to teach me anything about parenting.
And those are the people I key in on and try to get them to laugh at some point in the 4 hours. You usually can. Because when you start talking about their kids, they begin to loosen up. When they figure out you're not going to blame them and you're not going to tell them they're terrible, you tell them, okay, what are you worried about with your kids? What do you need to do? So one of my questions after we break the ice is, so how many of you have had something formal like marriage counseling to try to stay together before you filed for divorce? Anybody want to guess what the percentage runs? About five. about 5% of couples who are in the process of divorce, which got them ordered into this room, have actually done something to try to keep the relationship together. That blows me away. What that suggests is that the macro system has not yet accepted counseling, interpersonal education, basic social skills learning, emotional maturity, any of that. We've not accepted it as something that might be useful. So we break up the marriage and all of the problems that that brings with it, rather than go have somebody teach us something. So, they didn't do that. They should have. They should have done everything they could. Their children want them to do that. And if you're ever in that situation, remember that your children are going to think very poorly of you if you didn't do anything official, helpful, to try to keep the marriage together before you put them through this nasty stuff that goes on. So, there they are. They're divorced. Divorce ought to be the very last resort. After you've tried everything else, and it doesn't work, and you've finally given up, divorce ought to be the last thing that you do. And then, it should make everything work better. And when you watch couples divorce appropriately, they're thoughtful about it, and they do the work that they can do, they end up, and it's a very strange phenomenon that many people comment on it, that they suddenly feel like this great weight is lifted off their shoulders, and they suddenly get optimistic and hopeful, and they start getting happy, and they start relating better to their kids, both parents, because they're no longer in each other's space, and minds all the time. So divorce is a way to separate the parents into this binuclear family. It now has two nuclei that word was coined, as far as I know, by a woman named Connie Ahrens, who wrote a great book titled The Good Divorce. So it's like two eggs, two fried eggs. We got mom and we got dad. And it's one family. It happens to be a binuclear divorced family. But they both stay involved with the kids. And from the child's perspective, this is what the ecosystem of the family should look like. Two parents, both love you, both involved, they can't stand each other, that's okay, they don't tell me about that. And I happily have two bedrooms. I have two places where I can sleep. And it's okay, it's a hassle moving back and forth and whatever the transportation issues are. But if mom and dad manage that pretty well, then the kids can move from setting to setting. Think of all of the mesosystem hypotheses about goal consensus, about positive attitude, about positive affect between those two settings. If you know and you assume your view of the world is that you are one big happy binuclear family, and you apply all of those to make all the transitions as easy as possible. You are civil, if not really, really friendly, to each other. You don't badmouth the person in the other setting. Positive attitude toward the other setting. This creep you can't stand, but he is the father of your children. So if you take that view and do everything you can to make this a mesosystem family, and you do that as quickly as you can, and you maintain that, kids come out fine. Kids whose parents are able to do that come out fine. They will tell you when they're in college kids whose parents have done that will tell you that their parents' divorce ruined their lives a little bit. And they will tell you that because of their parents' divorce, they can't make commitments to anybody else. And they're afraid of relationships. I have a developmental secret for you. In college, everybody should be afraid of relationships. Everybody should be reluctant to make commitments to other people. That's developmentally normative. It has little to do with the parents' divorce, if anything. But we're happily, we go along with our invalid view of the world, which is that our parents' divorce taught us to be shy about relationships and reluctant to commit. But that's a very arguable point. Okay, what else happens? We've got no fault. So nobody is really the nasty person here, so there's nobody to tell the kids they should hate. And besides, kids don't like to be told to hate one of their parents. And they don't like it if you hate one of their parents. So the way to become the bad parent from the child's point of view is to be the nasty one, bad-mouthing the other one. It doesn't matter who was at fault originally. They will both change. And the kids will eventually respect and like the one who treats them in the most appropriately developmental way. That means joint activities, positive affect, complex joint activities, high reciprocity, all of those things that are developmentally appropriate. And neither parent has a monopoly on those. So parents are, once they separate, they are relatively free agents as they reestablish the parental role. When you've been together, remember we talked about what happens when couples are together cohabiting, male and female. There's pressure to move into traditional roles of she does this and he does that. When they have kids, there's more pressure to divide the labor in gendered ways. Moms are more likely to do more of the caretaking and caregiving, the nurturing. Dads are more likely to, I don't know, they teach about model railroads or something. They teach different things. But when they're in their own microsystems with kids, they don't have to do that division of labor. So one of the things that happens as couples create a mesosystem, a binuclear family, is that they each change the way they're involved with their children. And if they're doing it well, they both become the senior members in developmental dyads, the more developed people. And what often happens is that dads in our culture become much more involved in parenting because they pick up the kids from school, they bring them to their house. If dinner is going to get made, either the kids are going to do it or dad is going to do it. If a diaper is going to get changed, dad's going to do it. If kids are going to be entertained or taught, dad's going to do it. But when there's nobody else there, what dads discover is that, hey, they're grown-ups, they can do this. And they learn, and many of them learn very, very well. They may do it differently, the two genders, but that's okay. They just do it differently. This is a process of development for the father, usually, who now has the opportunity to fill a role that is not restricted by the presence of the other parent. You get to do it differently. So the microsystem that they establish has different places in it for the two parents because there's only one there. So the microsystem pattern involves the parental role differently. And many fathers, particularly, discover that, hey, they're pretty good parents, and they actually like this. Then a funny thing happens. They have agreed to have the kids every other weekend on Wednesday nights, because that's some... Moses, I think, brought that down, didn't he? That in the typical divorce division of time with the children, Dad will get every other weekend and Wednesday nights. And because Mom has been the primary caregiver in that traditional situation. As more and more women work when their children are young, that becomes less less common. But what happens is that Dad decides he actually likes spending time with the children and he wants more of it, so he goes back to court and says, I'd like to revise the parenting agreement because I'm really enjoying, I'm learning to be a father, I've never had the opportunity to do this, and I want more time with my kids. And women almost invariably, what should they do? Of course what they should do, right? They should say, hooray! You know, you finally developed. That's great. That's why I divorced you, you idiot. So you could learn to be a better parent and a better human being. So I'm really happy to revise this parenting agreement. So let's do it 50-50 now. I need more time by myself. I need time to date. You've had all this. So we'll do it. That's what mothers should do. Right? What do mothers do? The claws come out, they get a really nasty lawyer, and they say, no, 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 I won't give up my children, you're just harassing me, you're trying to steal my children from me, you're just trying to retaliate. And there's the poor dad saying, no, no, really, I just, you know, there are a limited number of hours in the week, and I'd like to share them more equally. And those are some of the nastiest battles that the court has to deal with, because you have a parent who really is developing and the other parent is not supporting the development, and we haven't reached the point yet where we automatically say both parents get half time, and that's the way it's going to be. We'll get there. It'll take another 25 years. We'll just presume 50-50 parenting. But we're not there yet. Alimony. We gave it up. Alimony was based on somebody being a bad person. So it was your punishment. Support this other parent for life. Now we do spousal support. People are responsible for supporting themselves. Women have as much education as men. Earning power isn't quite the same. But people should be supporting the children. And after 2 or 3 years of temporary support to go back and upgrade in education or get new skills, then parents should be supporting themselves and their children, but you do away with alimony or spousal support. On Monday I mentioned that the men used to get all the money and women got all the time with the children, and that wasn't quite fair. The alimony was based on the assumption that the husband was getting all the money and keeping all the money because it was his, and had the obligation, court ordered, to provide some support in the form of alimony to the woman. But since women can be employed and they do get more money as part of the settlement of finances now, that's no longer necessary. So it's usually temporary. It may be permanent if there's a very large income discrepancy and if one of the parents has limited earning ability, either because of age or disability or whatever. We don't talk about custody. The popular press still does. Custody is for felons, you know, people who've done wrong. Children are parented. Abby? Child support has changed. Because, as I mentioned on Monday, one of the issues was that we discovered that the way to become poor was to be a woman with children and get divorced, because you didn't have money and you didn't get any money in the settlement, or you didn't get very much. And what has happened, and this is the result of a federal child support law, which states were required to buy into, and the trade-off was that by buying into the federal system for child support, the states got federal enforcement. What happened up until 15 years ago was that if you didn't want to pay child support, you moved across the lake or across the river. All you had to do was go to a different state, because marriage, divorce, child support were all state functions, and the federal government had no laws applying to them at all. So all you had to do was move, and they couldn't collect child support. That became a popular activity, just getting out of the way. You could go earn whatever you wanted in New York City, and they couldn't collect it in Vermont. And if the other parent and tried to bring the kids to the state where you were, then they had to refile the whole thing, and most states took 10 years to deal with those. The new law says a child support order and child parenting agreements established by the state that has jurisdiction are enforceable in every state. And a state court may not interfere when another state's court has taken the original jurisdiction. You saw that in the paper Sunday, if you read the Free Press. You saw it in the paper Monday. Because the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a case which was decided in Vermont, and then Virginia tried to re-decide it in a different way, and it eventually got to a federal judge who said Virginia has nothing to say about it. The divorce was in Vermont. The visitation schedule, parenting schedule, was determined in Vermont, and what the mother did was move to Virginia to try to get a different order, and the Supreme Court just said, yeah, 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 yeah. It was a legal decision in Vermont. It was based on Vermont's civil union law. You went to Vermont. You got a civil union. That's a binding contract. You had a child. You separated and divorced, and Vermont decided that the other partner had a relationship with his child that the child and that partner deserved to keep. Therefore, the other mother will get to be with this child 1 month, 1 week a month. So the woman moved back to Virginia, said, ha, we don't recognize civil unions, so it's not valid here. Whatever Vermont said is not valid. And the lower court in Virginia agreed with her. Higher court in Virginia said, nope. Vermont had jurisdiction. Vermont keeps jurisdiction wherever you live. You want to move back to Vermont and renegotiate it, you can. But the federal law, and the Supreme Court just reasserted that, is that you have an agreement in Vermont. Vermont takes precedent. No other state can change that. Unless you both move to another state, then you can get it changed, but not likely to happen. So that was a result. And kids then stop being bounced around from state to state. The idea of the law in the federal law, which all states follow now, is that when you were a couple, you have a certain income level. And it doesn't matter who earns the money. You have mom and you have dad, but it's the family's income. That's what the marriage license did to you. And what used to happen is that because dads did earn most of the money, was after the divorce, moms got poor and dads got more discretionary income. The federal law says, to the extent possible, and dads would give a little bit, $50 a month, $75 a month, chicken feed. And now there are formulas which are determined, which take into account both parents earning capacity, what they ought to be earning, and then transfer so that both parents have equal resources. What that means is that kids have the maximum resources available to them. If they're going to be in both households, those households should not be discrepant from each other, unless the discrepancy is created by another party, such as a step-parent, who contributes to that household. Step-parent's income doesn't count, just the parents. So about 15 years ago, child support payments went, and men are still screaming and talking about getting blood out of turnips and trying to find ways to keep from supporting their children, and I have no sympathy with those at all. Yes. The question is whether the formulas take into account how much each parent works and how much time each child spends with the parents. To some extent, some of that is not considerable. Food is. Clothes you have to wear wherever you are. A bedroom is not rented for 30% of the month. Just because you have kids, you pay the rent. So it's year-round. You provide the basic resources, the infrastructure, as we call it, for the family. The only thing that really is adjustable is food. And the calculations take into account how much of the week or the month the child is with each parent, and there's an adjustment for that. But otherwise, medical bills, health insurance, all of those sorts of things are presumed to be provided equally, unless the parents agree that there's a different way to do that. And parents often do that. For example, somebody will have health insurance that is much less expensive than the other person, so they'll agree to do some trading. Some of you have parents where one of them pays your room and board and the other one pays your car and health insurance and stuff like that, and that's fairly common.
Is there any like measure to see or make sure that the child support is spent on the child?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Is there any requirement or anything to check the fact that the child support is being spent on the children?
No. The question is there any way to enforce whether or not the child support is being spent on the children? No, there are some techniques for doing that where people are not particularly trustworthy with money. But the assumption is that it is that portion of the cost of the household that is attributable to having a child in it. And I regularly get calls from people who want me to calculate the cost of keeping a child. I routinely lose those requests. It's absolutely impossible to figure out what it costs to raise a child. And there are people better equipped to do it than I am, but I've been asked to go to court, and then I won't tackle that one. I'm not an economist, and I keep my own checkbook balanced part of the time, so I'm not going to worry about it. But it is a common complaint between divorced parents that, you know, why should I have to give her money when she spends it on clothes for herself? The court's presumption is that people will take care of their children to the best they can, and if there is solid evidence that a person is not doing that, if a person is in fact spending money that he or she doesn't have and neglecting the bills that are related to children, then there are techniques that courts can impose that require documentation of the expenditures. And sometimes they will appoint a trustee for the child so that somebody is taking care of those bills. And there are a number of ways you can do that. When you know that one person has a credit card problem and the money is not likely to be spent where it's supposed to be spent. But the starting presumption is that everybody's going to take care of their kids as best they can. And since most parents actually do that, It seems to be a fairly safe presumption. Did that get all the way through what you had asked, Abby? No. Okay. What do parents fight over? Money. After they're divorced. That's what you've got to fight over. And that's why it's important just to decide when you get married, during that brief window of time when you really like each other and trust each other, Uncle Larry recommends you write your divorce agreement while you love each other. You just write it all down and say, okay, if, and it will never happen, but if we ever get divorced, we will divide our parenting time down the middle. We will divide any assets we have accumulated down the middle. No questions asked. We will both contribute equally or proportionally to our incomes, to our children's college funds and their education. We will both support them. We will never badmouth each other. It's real easy to promise all that stuff when you love each other. So it should just be part of the marriage. You know, if for some reason we can't live together, we're going to treat each other and our children wonderfully well. And we're not going to fight about things that we don't need to fight about. What happens is that people assume they love each other, they will never get divorced. This is a bad bet. Remember, 48% first marriages. More than 50% of first marriages with children end in divorce. So the probability, if you were going to the casino and you were going to bet on it, you might as well just flip a coin. But of course, you would never divorce the person that you're marrying when you marry them because you love them. And because you love each other, you don't have to talk about important stuff. You don't have to agree on anything because it'll never come up. And if it does, well, because you love each other, you will agree. There's a phrase from Bronfenbrenner. It's called a valid view of the world that you live in. And that view is a hallucination. That view that you will love each other, therefore you'll never disagree, and therefore you don't have to talk about any of this stuff. And the superstitious belief that if you talk about divorce, you'll make it happen. Those are hallucinations. They're delusions. And what happens really is that then people begin not to like each other, and then they skip the counseling, and they go to get a divorce, and they discover suddenly that they have a pretty interesting disagreement about the other person's parenting role and about whose money it is. And they will fight tooth and nail about who gets time with the children and whose money it is. And they will make each other crazy. And because they're grieving and they're all upset anyway and they don't know how to go through this process and they're getting bad advice from everybody and they're paying their lawyers $150 an hour, they will proceed to make very bad decisions. And they will say things that will come back to haunt them forever. If you do the agreement when you get married or when your first child is born, that's another good time. Okay, we had this child. Now we're both parents. That means we're going to divide parenting time and responsibility down the middle. And if we ever get divorced, we're going to split the kid 50-50. Right? Easy to do. Then, when you get divorced, you pull out the agreement. This is what we agreed to. Now, a lawyer will tell you it's probably not enforceable. Can't enforce it. But lawyers don't have what we call moral persuasion, which is, this is what you signed when you loved me. This is what I'm going to tell our children you agreed to. And if you now don't agree to it, they're going to wonder what happened to your morality. That's called moral authority. It's blackmail? Sure. Okay. But you do want to live up to your agreements with your children. Otherwise, they think you're a hypocrite. And they will say, you know, Daddy, you agreed that you were going to divide the assets down the middle and spend half your time with us. We've got that piece of paper. Mommy photocopied it for us. What gives? Just imagine yourself as a parent facing a child with that in their hands. But if you don't make the agreement, that won't happen. Okay. We don't visit our children and they don't visit us. until after they finish college and move out finally. You know, then they can come back to visit. But children spend time with their parents, so we don't use the word visitation. It's not broken, it's divorced, it's not single parent, it's binuclear. We still talk about parental rights, but it's more important to talk about parental responsibilities, to spend time and think about all the responsibilities to create and maintain a developmental dyad with your children, including complex motor activities, easy access, high degree of reciprocity, positive affect, and support for the other parent. That's a parental responsibility. Support of the other parent's relationship. And the fundamental principle that's been used now for probably 45 years is what is in the best interest of the child. That is what the court eventually must decide. If parents can't agree, then you get to decide, the court will get to decide on the basis of what it believes the best interests of the child are. What we think are the best interests of the child are a moving target. As we get more research, as we understand the process of divorce better, we keep changing what is in the best interests of the child. So that's a macrosystem set of beliefs, and we still talk about it, but we also argue a lot about what is in the best interest. Okay. So in each case, you have the macro system suggesting different language and different beliefs, different ways of dealing with the changes that are taking place in the family as it goes through all of these transitions. So let's assume we've got them. Let me stop there and see if there are questions, because there may be things that I've jumped over that might be useful. Okay. One thing from the macro system that I didn't mention, I've alluded to divorce attorneys, the sharks we call them, the barracudas, the nasty people. I don't have anything against attorneys if they're on my side. The problem in our macro system is that attorneys, by their ethics, have to represent the best interests of their client. And in an adversarial situation such as divorce, they may not represent both parties, because husband and wife are presumed to have different interests. So they can't represent both. So attorneys have to take the position of the parent who hires them. And that creates in our legal system the potential for conflict between the parents, because they're being represented by attorneys who have to represent them enthusiastically, even if they are full of crap, even if the parent is full of crap. You still have to represent the parent fully. The problems in doing that are one of the reasons that many attorneys who make their income when they're young on divorces stop doing divorces as quickly as they can, because it's not a pleasant kind of process. Others decide they will become mediators, and they can sit down with both parties, but they don't represent them. They provide a mediation service so the parties can argue and hassle, and they help them come to an agreement if they can. But then the parties have to take their agreement to attorneys who will review it for them, attorneys who are not the mediator. You can also be a mediator if you're looking for a very interesting profession. You can do that without becoming a lawyer. Lots of people are mediators. You can get a master's at Woodbury College and several other places in mediation, and do that as a process. It's a much nicer way to sort of sit people down and say, let's think about your children. What do you want? How are we going to work this out? When people can't agree within the adversarial system of the court, they end up spending a lot of money getting experts. They get evaluations. They end up calling each other names in court. And the legal system is set up so that if two parents on their own or with a mediator come to an agreement about how they're going to divide everything up, including time with the kids and what the schedule is going to be and who's responsible for what, the court will take that agreement, look at it, say, is this bad for the kids? Are the kids' rights protected? Okay, sign it. That's the way it goes. And 90% of divorces in Vermont are done that way. The other 10% end up in a hearing. It's probably about 8% now. They end up in a hearing, and the couples present their views, and then, as my favorite family court judge says, then I go into my chambers, and I don't know this family at all, but they've just told me how much they hate each other. And so here I am. I get to decide which of them gets which television, who has to pay the car loan, which one gets Wednesday night with which kid, who gets the weekends, who's responsible for medical care, who gets to make the decisions about where the kid goes to church and where the kid goes to school. And I'm making these on the basis of what they've told me in court when they hate each other. And I'm not permitted to talk to the children. I do it as nicely as I can, and I do it as fairly for the kids, and I'm a mom, she says, I do this. But so why any couple would bring their children to court and ask us to saw them in half, I have no idea. We need to find other ways for them to do that. But she had good training for that. She's no longer a family court judge in Vermont. She's presiding over war crimes trials in Bosnia. And divorce court was good training for that. Yeah. I think that one's on the web. Okay, then come a series of transitions. We create the binuclear household. And we get that sorted out. And then mom starts dating. Dad starts dating. And each of them is now developing new dyadic relationships. Ideally, they have both become comfortable with their dyadic relationships with the children. Each of them has created a stable microsystem that includes the children. Each of them has become comfortable with the role of parent. And after they've done that, which takes a couple of years, then they can start dating. And, well, some start dating before that. In fact, some start dating before they separate, which is making a very confused situation. But at some point, people are going to create this new mesosystem. They're going to create new dyadic relationships. And how they do that is, for most people, unprecedented. How do you date when you have children? And at what point do you force your children to call the man you're dating daddy? I've watched a few of those, where the complaint between the divorced couple is that she is forcing the 3-year-old to call her new boyfriend daddy, and dad objects to that, and so does the 3-year-old, who doesn't know this person from Adam and doesn't want to call him daddy. In fact, doesn't like him at all. In fact, doesn't want him in the household and resents the time that he spends with mom because it's messing up his microsystem. All of the dating experiences change the microsystem and the mesosystem for the child. And parents can do that slowly and carefully and comfortably, or they can do it like bulls in china shops. and the bull in the china shop approach is not very good for children. Since people who start dating and start spending the night out while their kids stay with the babysitter or great aunt Harriet or whoever, they're creating a very messy situation for kids that will eventually collapse or result in kids not developing particularly well. So we try to get people to be sensible about introducing new people, about dating only when they don't have time with the children, which is one of the reasons to divide time with children in half, so each of you has not quite enough time to date, but at least some. And encourage people to be full-time parents when they have the children with them, because there's only one of them. Some people aren't comfortable with the role, so they bring somebody else in to play it. Move the girlfriend in because you haven't figured out how to do the laundry yet. But if you move the girlfriend in, then she can take care of the kids and you don't have to learn the new role. And she can take care of your laundry. And why any girlfriend would let herself get suckered into that, I'm not sure. But it's usually because they want to rescue the children. I'm not going to comment any more on that one. I start to foam at the mouth when I get into the ridiculous things that people do in the name of love that are not particularly good for other people's children. And rescuing them from their parent is one of those things that's not terribly good in the long run for the children or for you if you're in that situation. Eventually, from the child's point of view, what you'd like to have is a really nice person who becomes another dyadic person with you. So we get mom's boyfriend who eventually becomes a stepfather, and there he is. And you get dad's boyfriend who becomes a stepfather. This is Vermont, right? So you can have dad's boyfriend. You can have mom's girlfriend. And so you end up with four adults. And that person is connected some way to another parent out here and maybe other children who then become part of the child's mesosystem, and it can get very complicated. From the child's point of view, the child's view of the appropriate ecosystem is that anybody who loves me and who feels obligated to help me grow up is part of my family. They're just part of my family. So when you ask kids to tell you who's in their family, they'll tell you about dad's boyfriend and mom's boyfriend and mom's boyfriend's ex-wife and their three children. And all of these people, as far as the child is concerned, become part of the family. And to the extent that the grown-ups are doing a reasonable job, that's what's happening. They're creating this very complex mesosystem family, or as one student called it a couple of years ago, a messy system family. It is messy, and you have to remember, you know, which grandparent this is and whose grandparent it is, because you have step-step grandparents, and then you have half-siblings, and you never know, it's the top half or bottom half. It's half. This is the half-kid. We share a parent. And you have full siblings, and you have half-siblings, and you have step-siblings, and you have to learn all the kinship stuff. But if parents are doing it right, they accept every reasonable person into this mesosystem family and acknowledge their legitimate relationship with the child. And then we move directly into it takes a village to raise children, and you're creating a village. And in the long run, if you're a Bronfenbrennerian, what you're doing is creating multiple developmental dyads for the child, a tightly connected mesosystem, a variety of people and roles to interact with, all those good things. As long as everybody in the family accepts the legitimacy of everybody else. That's the hard part. Accepting that your kid's stepmother is actually okay is something that many people never get to. But from the child's point of view, a valid view of the ecosystem in blended families is that everybody who is committed to the group is okay. And you may be creating a very rich experience for the child. And when it works well, that's what's happening. The problems come when people don't get over their conflict with each other and don't accept new people coming in as adults in their household with their children, taking a role with their children. The argument that people who accept it make is that, you know, you see situations where people don't have enough parents, where something happens to a parent and there you are, you're hung out to dry because you don't have enough adults in your life. And you end up in foster care sometimes. Wouldn't it be better if kids had 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 adults who were committed to them as members of the family? We used to call that an extended family. Now it's a blended family. And probably if we think about it, we can create a term called the extended blended family or something like that. But we're creating a group of people who are committed to the development of the children because they are the children of people to whom we are committed. The roles are different, they're not the same, but you can create an ecosystem for the child that is supportive in every possible way. But it takes the adults usually time, and it takes a good deal of intelligence to recognize that in the long run, for your child, having multiple adults who are committed to the child is better than having the child just be yours and then be that parent who gets hit by a truck and your kid doesn't have any place to go because you haven't promoted the relationships with other adults. And that happens. It happens. Okay. I got 2 minutes. Good wishes. Boy, where did the semester go? All right. There you go. So, these are my good wishes. I wish for you throughout your lives many wonderful primary dyads manifesting positive affect, a high degree of reciprocity, and a comfortable balance of power. Many developmental dyads, some in which you are the less developed person, and some in which you're the more developed person. A lifetime of satisfying molar activities, some solitary, some joint. Harmonious, secure, and supportive home microsystems. A richly linked mesosystem comprising settings that are engaging, challenging, and rewarding. An exosystem favorably disposed to your development. Watch who you vote for. Developmental trajectories through increasingly satisfying, rewarding, and productive settings, promoting patterns of motivation and activity that serve you and your society well. Can you just imagine this on your Christmas card or your birthday card? Anyway? The ability to understand your ecosystem and to manage it effectively so that it supports your development and the development of those for whom you care. Opportunities to participate in a wide variety of macrosystems. Travel and explore. Steady progress in the development of a more differentiated and valid view of your ecosystem and the skills necessary to maintain and improve your ecosystem. And Talia joins me, although she disappeared a few minutes ago to go to class. She joins me in wishing you all of those things for the rest of your life from us and from Uncle Uri Bronfenbrenner. Okay. We'll start a review session in about 8 minutes.